From the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, Southern Poverty Law on the Appellate Court, Texas Heartbeat Bill is upheld, and Musk buys Twitter. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and Reagan Republican. On Wednesday, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing on controversial appeals court pick Nancy Abudu. Abudu has been a strategic legislation director at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Here's a question from Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley about the SPLC's hate group list, of which Family Research Council is one of its targets.
Would you consider those organizations as a hate group?
Senator, I wouldn't even be able to comment to that because I'm not as familiar with those organizations in terms of the work that they do, their mission, and again, why SPLC profiled them in that way.
Well, joining us now is Senator Chuck Grassley, the ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Can you believe that she would say that she doesn't know anything about this? I finished up my questioning with this comment. I said, over a period of several years, if you're just reading regular newspaper or commentaries about politics in Washington, D.C. and about your organization, you would know that these organizations has been listed in a very negative way by the center that you work for. And it just doesn't make her answers to my question credible that she doesn't know that an organization 10 or 15 years ago she was associated with, and now since 2019 associated again, that she didn't know anything about the history of this organization. She's oblivious to these things, but it's not credible that she say that.
Senator, I would have to agree with you. I would find it hard to believe that she would not be familiar with their list ranking all of these conservative groups as hate groups. I would have to question her credibility if she's not aware of a major portion of what that organization does.
Yeah. We're more concerned probably with her filling in details of legislation, putting her personal views into court decisions. If she wants to lean a statute a little bit one way or the other way, or maybe she doesn't believe in the original intent of the Constitution, things of that nature are really bigger than whether she knows this or not. But she hurts her credibility when she says she's oblivious to these accusations by her center on whether or not these Christian organizations are terrorist type organizations or hate organizations, whatever you want to call them.
Well, Senator, let me get to the issue of what you and I have talked about before, and that is judicial philosophy, because that's what we're looking at in these judicial nominees. Are they going to call balls and strikes? Are they just simply going to interpret the law and do their role? I think, and I want to ask you, does she fall into the category of an activist when it comes to her judicial philosophy?
I sure think so. I'm submitting, you know, you only have 5 minutes to ask questions, so I submit a lot of questions for answer in writing, and I'll probably wait until 2 weeks from now when those answers have to be returned to give you a definitive answer. But everything with her background, ACLU, the center she works for now, things of that nature, that's generally the type of person you get from those organizations, that they're very political activists. They believe in big government. They believe that you and I don't know anything, and Washington has all the answers to everything. And Congress is not a democratic organization, small d democratic organization, and it takes a long time to get policy through the Congress of the United States. And boy, it's real easy to get a judge to make a decision that's favorable to you. And remember, 99 9/10% of all the cases are finally decided by circuits. And she's going to be on the 11th Circuit. So she's kind of a Supreme Court, except for about 70 or 80 cases out of the year.
Senator, she's clearly extreme, but she's kind of reflective of what we're seeing from the Biden administration in terms of the type of candidates that he is nominating. And when you look at what we had 4 years ago and the judges that were appointed by the Trump administration that you helped get onto to the bench, and then you look at what President Biden is doing, I actually think that's a really stark contrast that shows the differences, the governing ideological difference between the two parties in our country.
It does. And it goes back to the role of judges in our society. Are they going to be activists? Are they going to be a super legislature? Are they trying to put their views in place of those of the elected representatives of the people? Do they think that they ought to change the law, maybe just a little bit, maybe a lot, but more often just a little bit, instead of deferring to the Congress of the United States? That's basically what's wrong. We have a 6-3 conservative decision on the Supreme Court now, and you're already seeing some benefit from that, from these regulations that are being overturned just because they aren't following the Administrative Procedures Act of 1946, as just one example. So they're saying, these six conservatives are saying, Congress ought to do its job. And I agree Congress ought to do its job. And I also agree that the courts of the United States ought to have deference to the legislative branch of government, that they should not be a part of it.
So, Senator Grassley, does Ms. Abudu get confirmed?
Well, if her vote was on the floor today with two or three Democratic senators having COVID and the vice president not also having COVID, not being able to be there, no, she wouldn't be approved. But if there's 50 Democrat votes, I don't want to say that there might not be two or three Republicans that might vote for her, but for somebody this extreme, sometimes you get all Republicans vote against. And if the vice president's available, she could be approved 51-50. Yes.
You can find out more about Senator Grassley when you visit TonyPerkins.com. That's TonyPerkins.com.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's Stand Firm mobile app. This tool serves to bring Christians across America together, advancing faith, family, and freedom. With the Stand Firm app, you will have all of our content available at your fingertips and will conveniently be able to stay up to date throughout your busy day. The Stand Firm app will give you access to a variety of resources, such as our most recent radio programs, social media posts, and publications. Additionally, you will have the opportunity to take action and make your voice heard by contacting your elected officials on the issues that most concern you. Visit the App Store on your smartphone or mobile device and search Stand Firm to download FRC's Stand Firm app, or by going to frc.org/app.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Earlier this week, a federal court dismissed all challenges to the Texas Heartbeat Act by ruling that because state officials aren't responsible for enforcing the Texas Heartbeat Act, abortion companies are unable to sue the state. The court provided yet another win for the pro-life movement. This comes as we await the Supreme Court's ruling in the Dobbs case. Joining Tony Perkins to discuss the ruling is former Solicitor General of Texas, Jonathan Mitchell.
Jonathan, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me, Tony. Good to be with you.
Well, first, let me start with this. Your reaction to the federal court's dismissal this week of all challenges to the Heartbeat Act.
It was expected, you know, because the Supreme Court of the United States and the Supreme Court of Texas together have already held that there's no one left for the abortion providers to sue. So this ruling we got from the Fifth Circuit earlier this week was just a formality. In terms of my reaction, I think it shows that we know this tactic works, and any state can restrict abortion now as it sees fit without waiting for the Supreme Court to overrule Roe against Wade. All they have to do is copy what Texas did. We have the blueprint.
All right. I got to step back for just a moment, Jonathan, and ask you this question. I mean, we're nearly 50 years at the decision of Roe v. Wade. How did you come about taking this approach?
We needed to try a different approach to what we had been doing before. And what happens under the undue burden standard that the Supreme Court invented, it's a highly vague test. It's hard to predict how a Supreme Court will rule when you enact legislation. And what we had been doing in the past was enacting statutes, not knowing whether they would ultimately hold up in court, waiting for the pro-abortion groups to sue the state officials in order to get an injunction, and then have to pay out millions of dollars in attorney's fees if we guessed wrong. We had to change the tactics that we were using and do more to just box out the federal judiciary from even having jurisdiction to consider the cases. And that's what Texas did.
Now, Jonathan, is this similar to what we saw back in the 80s? We saw a little bit of an attempt, at, I don't think it worked, to go after abortion for liability for committing abortions. We saw for a while that effort was used more in the civil courts, but it never caught traction. What made this different?
The difference here is that they're expanding the scope of potential plaintiffs by allowing any person to sue, essentially taking away the state's enforcement power and giving it to private citizens rather than putting it in the hands of state officials. And by structuring the law this way, there's no way for the abortion providers to come into federal court and challenge the statute pre-enforcement because they have to wait for someone to sue them first and then assert whatever constitutional claims they want to make in a defensive posture. So the difference here is that the statute has taken away affirmatively the authority of state officials to enforce the act and given that power instead to the private citizenry. And there's no way for the abortion providers to know in advance who's going to sue them. So that's why they can't challenge the statute in court pre-enforcement.
So we're at a point now, the court has dismissed the challenges, but do you anticipate any other challenges from different angles coming at this law in the days and weeks ahead?
There are some still challenges pending in federal court and state court, but they don't involve claims for statewide relief. They're individual plaintiffs suing individual defendants. So even if those lawsuits were successful from the standpoint of the abortion providers, they're not going to be able to get a statewide injunction that stops the law from being enforced. And that's really what they need if they want the abortion clinics to start reopening and providing post-heartbeat abortions again. They don't really have any roadmap right now to get to that result, given what happened at the Supreme Court.
Now, from a cultural standpoint, and I'm not speaking to it from a legal standpoint, I'm going to let you do that, but I would think this really changes the landscape for the Supreme Court as they consider the Dobbs case. I think this sets the stage where the court has to take action to push this back to the states.
It already has been pushed back to the states because Texas's law has shown that states already can get around Roe against Wade simply by adopting this tactic. So whether the Supreme Court overrules Roe and Dobbs becomes less significant because Texas and later today Oklahoma, they've just recently passed a similar law that's enforced through private citizen suits. Both of these states have shown other states how they can get around Roe without waiting for the Supreme Court to overrule it. So if Dobbs does overrule Roe against Wade, that will allow states to reinstate their traditional abortion prohibitions that are enforced through criminal law, through conventional public enforcement. But the key point to keep in mind is that right now, states have the ability to restrict abortion in any manner they see fit simply by using this enforcement tactic through private civil lawsuits rather than conventional public enforcement by state officials.
Well, Jonathan, I think it's brilliant. We've got 30 seconds left, but do you see this model being used for other aspects of law?
We'll have to see whether it can go outside the abortion context. It's hard to know because you always have to motivate a legislature to enact a law like this. Legislators are politicians. They respond to political incentives. There were very strong incentives in a state like Texas to enact this law to circumvent Roe against Wade because that decision is not held in very high regard by the Texas legislators. It's hard for me to imagine other Supreme Court decisions that provoke the same type of opposition as Roe. So I'm not expecting this to be used widely outside the abortion context, but it's possible it will if there's future Supreme Court decisions that engender similar type of opposition that Roe against Wade did.
All right. Jonathan Mitchell, again, tremendous job. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I appreciate your work. Americans, upholding the sanctity of human life.
You can find out more about the life issue and the Texas heartbeat bill when you visit TonyPerkins.com. That's TonyPerkins.com.
As the ever-changing political and cultural landscape of our nation has shifted to cater to the left's ideologies on foundational topics, it is now more imperative than ever that Christians are equipped with biblical answers for difficult questions. FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, David Clausen, responds to this need with his Biblical Worldview series. Visit frc.org/worldview to read the full publications. That's frc.org/worldview.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Well, there's been a lot of tweeting since Twitter announced on Tuesday that entrepreneur Elon Musk, the world's richest person, acquired the company for $44 billion. Twitter employees reportedly reacted mostly with shock and dismay and were pulled in for an internal town hall on Monday afternoon to receive assurances from the company's CEO and board chair. What could be ahead for the social media platform that a decade ago declared itself to be the free speech wing of the free speech party? Joining Tony to talk about this is Joel Berry, managing editor at the Babylon Bee, the well-known Christian satire website that Twitter suspended last month for naming Rachel Levine its Man of the Year. Here's Tony Perkins.
Joel, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me.
So what is your reaction to yesterday's announcement?
Well, it's been a fun couple days. The meltdown, I think, has been a bit fun to watch. And, you know, we are, you know, obviously we're not in communication with Musk or anything, but we do hope that at some point we'll see a reversal of some of these policies and some of these suspensions that we've seen over the last couple years. You know, and a return to a culture of free speech on the platform. I think you mentioned Twitter, you know, originally branded itself as like the free speech platform of the free speech party. And over time, it definitely did lose its way. I think it got in bed with the government a little bit too much. It almost to the point where it became a bit of a de facto arm of the government that the government was using to squash dissent, squash criticism in a way that wouldn't violate the Constitution, you know, almost laundering their censorship of opposition through this private third party, Twitter. And so it had become a very corrupt situation. And I'm excited about the future. It does feel like kind of a new beginning for Twitter.
You know, Joel, I have to ask you, you know, I'm a big fan of Babylon Bee. You know, those that know me well know that I have a sense of humor. Other people don't think I have a sense of humor, but I like the Babylon Bee. And, you know, what does it say about, and all your stuff is satire. I mean, you're poking fun, and I like that. I mean, it's funny. It's funny, and it's good to laugh. But what does it say about a society that cannot tolerate satire? What does that tell us?
Yeah, well, I think it tells us that the prevailing worldview of our society can't stand up to ridicule. And you know, it's called many things these days. You know, a lot of people kind of use the pejorative term wokeness to describe it. But there has been this kind of this brand new morality, this worldview that has been built up. It's come from the universities. It's kind of, you know, infiltrated all of our systems and our institutions. And it can't really stand up to much of anything, ridicule, logic, questioning, but especially ridicule. I think, you know, there are very few things that can stand up to ridicule. And that's why it's such a powerful tool, especially in this day and age when, you know, I think our attention spans are shorter. There aren't a lot of people reading long think pieces. But a little 1-2 punch of a joke can get a message out there in a way that catches people off guard and can send the opposition on its, you know, put them on their heels a little bit. And so I think the other side recognizes the power of satire, the power of ridicule and mockery, and that's why they've attacked it.
Well, they certainly do know the power of it because they use it quite effectively in the legacy media. But they cannot stand a punch back. I love the way the left operates. You know, it's kind of like the parents aren't looking and the younger one kicks the other one. And when he strikes back, he says, oh, look, he started it. And that's what we hear repeatedly is that conservatives are the ones picking these fights. Now, we're just having conversations. We're happy to debate these issues. We're happy to debate. How in the world did you come about with Rachel Levin being the woman of the year? I mean, we can have those conversations. They can't because they can't defend it.
Yeah, it's true. I think one thing that I always say is that, and I think this has probably been said and by other people many other ways, but you know, I think the right wants the left to keep talking, and we invite it, and the left wants the right to shut up, because when the left talks, people are kind of repulsed by their ideas when they're presented honestly, but people are compelled by our ideas. And so I think that anyone who comes in, you know, like Elon Musk with this agenda to bring all ideas into the light, to give them all a fair chance to debate and to present what they think is the truth. It's a huge threat to people who really thrive in secrecy, thrive in darkness, and thrive in an environment where there is kind of a thumb on the scale in their favor.
Well, Joel, I think this is what the left has been about for the really. It's been unfolding intently in the last decade. I've watched it from my vantage point in Washington, but I kind of revert back to my days as a police officer. And when you're in a situation where you have potential danger in an explosive environment, maybe a hostage situation, you want to keep the people talking. You want conversation because that's the way things are resolved. You know you're in trouble when communication breaks down and there is silence. That's when bad things happen. And so I use that to talk about we are a very divided nation, no question about it. Ideologically, religiously, spiritually, you know, well, you pick it. We're divided. However, there was a time when we had conversations. I remember when I first came to the Family Research Council 19 years ago, I was on MSNBC almost every week on Chris Matthews' Hardball, debating. And so we were having these conversations. As long as you're debating, you're actually, sometimes you change someone else's mind. Sometimes they, you know, they might change yours, but you're having conversation. When that shuts down and there is silence, that's when we're in real trouble.
I wholeheartedly agree. You know, and I think the same goes for laughter. I think if we can't laugh together about something, that's a real sign that our culture isn't healthy. And I think the thing that I love about the Babylon Bee and the effect that we have on the culture sometimes is sometimes we are able to induce shared laughter on both sides. And those are my most rewarding days. When I see a leftist or a progressive or an atheist laughing at a Babylon Bee joke, you know, in spite of the fact that maybe they don't agree with our worldview and some of the premises of the joke, they laugh at the cleverness of it, or maybe kind of subconsciously acknowledge some of the truth of it. And I think when we can laugh together, in addition to, you know, communicating and debating,
absolutely,
that's a really healthy thing.
It really is. I mean, I know some of the kind of the spoofs on the church folks that the Babylon Bee does. I find amusing because, you know, what humor is? There's a little bit of truth in it, and you're able to kind of blow it up and magnify it, and it's really funny. And I think you're absolutely right. It's healthy to be able to laugh, and I think it's good to be able to laugh at yourself. You know, none of us are perfect. We all make mistakes, and there's things about us. We all have our quirks, and it's if we can laugh about those, we're healthier, and the world around us is healthier. But when you can't laugh, or you can't take, as you said, a little jabbing or ridicule, we're in a really bad place.
Yeah, that's true. I think, and it is very important at the Babylon Bee to turn the cannon towards ourselves every once in a while. Like you said, we're all silly. We're all a little silly. We all make mistakes. We're all sinners. And I think it's important to kind of acknowledge that whether we're on the left or on the right, whatever our religion or our politics are, we're all kind of we all can be a little hypocritical and a little silly sometimes. And before God, we're all, you know, in a pretty desperate place in need of him. So I think that's sometimes the joke, whether consciously or not, people are acknowledging that when they laugh at some of the joke. We're all a little silly.
Yeah. And I think God has a sense of humor.
That's right.
Yeah, I can see it. So let's just very quickly, before we run out of time, Joel, are you optimistic? I mean, I personally am optimistic with Musk making this purchase, because why is he going to spend $44 billion for status quo? He's got to be making some changes, or hope to, because, you know, Twitter has been, you know, was a place, a public square where we could have conversations, where we could laugh, where we could poke fun. I don't think he's going to maintain the status quo. I would think he's going to change things up quite a bit.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Elon Musk, he's an outside-the-box thinker. I think that's in his nature. He has talked a lot about the potential of taking Twitter open source, which I think would be a great idea, you know, for people all around the world to kind of customize their own Twitter experience, what they want to see, what they don't want to see, without some kind of shadowy you know, corporation deciding what you see and don't see. You know, he has Starlink, which could potentially, you know, bring access to Twitter to anywhere in the world, closed off countries, places where there is no access to internet. And so I think it's a really exciting time for Twitter, social media, free speech right now. Obviously, you know, this is a Bible verse I share with the other writers today, you know, I think from Hosea, place not your trust in princes, you know, their plans come to naught. You know, everyone dies, we're mortal, but blessed are those whose trust is in the God of Jacob. And so, you know, ultimately our trust is in God. He uses powerful men to accomplish his purposes one way or the other. And that's where our hope lies. So we're kind of here, sitting back and enjoying the ride and enjoying watching to see what God does and trusting in his plan, no matter where it goes. So.
All right, you're looking for any writers? Maybe I could work part-time for you.
Hey, yeah, you got send them in. I take submissions via email anytime, so let me know.
All right. Joel, great to talk with you. And again, appreciate what you guys do at the Babylon Bee. Really enjoy it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us. I look forward to having you back here again next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.